So, as I was reading Jason's book, I tried to find a way to think about it and to talk about it. And in the middle of the book, Jason says, question everything. And I thought it could be a good starting point to address the book. But very fast I realized it's quite a hard book to question. And I think the reason why it's hard to question, and the way it's hard to question, is quite interesting and can tell us a lot about what the book is about and how the book works. So I think the first reason why it's hard to question is that it's a handbook and it's not an essay. So it deals more with questions like how to do this or how to deal with this than question like what is this. And so it's not like it's a choreographer's handbook, and it's not an essay on choreography, on essay on composition. So Jason proposes ways of doing things, ways of conceiving choreography and composition, but he doesn't try to tell us what is choreography, what is composition, or what are the current trends in choreography. And it's different types of discourses. So it's not a descriptive discourse that will tell us what are things, but it's a pragmatic discourse that is oriented toward action and practice. And Jason does define some terms, but he defines them many times. So for example, there are many, many different definitions of what composition or what choreography could be. And the fact that there are many different definitions that sometimes might contradict each other shows that the definitions are there as working hypotheses. They don't claim to tell us any truth or to have a theoretical coherence or something like that. They are there to trigger fruitful practices. So in the way I was going to question the book, I had to take into account that it's written in such a pragmatic way and not a descriptive way. But that was not the main problem. The main problem was that it's a very weird handbook. It's not like a normal handbook. Like, it's not like a normal handbook for cooking or embroidery or I don't know. So if you read this kind of handbook, you have precise goals and you have precise criteria that you have to fulfill. Like if you want to make a proper Christmas pudding, you have some requirements that you have to fulfill. And if you don't, you're not making a Christmas pudding. But you don't have requirements for making a dance piece. I mean, there are no criteria that you should do, and then if you fulfill those criteria, you have a good dance piece. And certainly, Jason doesn't give us such criteria that would allow us to make a good dance piece. So, as opposed to more traditional handbook, it's an open-ended handbook. And one of the consequences of that is that Jason is more proposing ways of questioning things than actually ways of answering or way of affirming what things are, and even ways of doing things. So Jason proposes a lot of ways of questioning how we go about doing choreography and composition, and also he questions himself a lot. So each time that there is something that could be something like an explicit principle or an explicit criteria for making a piece, Jason questions it. For example, at some point he says, maybe what you do most easily is the most original thing you could do. So here we could be like, great, I have a principle. If I want to make a piece, I should do what comes easily. But then right after he says, or maybe the thing you do most easily are habits you should question. And there I had a problem, because at first I had decided to question what Jason Bowes was going to say, but Jason Bowes was only questioning things. So I had to question the action of questioning, and Jason Bowes is questioning himself, so I had to question questioning. And of course that's a contradiction, because if I'm questioning, I'm not really questioning it, since I'm questioning it. So, I mean, this is a bit messy, but you get the idea that we enter a logical contradiction. And that, so I was a bit stuck, I was a bit in a dead end, and I was like, how am I going to continue to question what Jason is saying? So I had to kind of step back and try to find another way to think about things in order to keep my inquiry and to keep questioning. So I started to wonder if it was really possible to make a handbook with absolutely no criteria, no implicit criteria, no sense of what is a good dance piece and what is a good composition or a good choreography. So I thought maybe if Jonathan is not giving explicit criteria, or if he's questioning all the explicit criteria he could be giving us, maybe there can be some implicit criteria I can draw out of the general approach to composition that he has. And so if we look at the way, my understanding of the way Jonathan's think about composition is that it's not necessary for a piece to be beautiful, it's not necessary for a piece to be coherent, it's not even necessary for a piece to be understandable, it's not necessary for it to be smart, it can be silly, but it has to do something, it has to hold the attention of the audience. So a piece has to hold the attention of the audience, and a piece cannot be boring. Of course I have a problem here, because Jonathan questioned that in his book. He says, being bored is not necessarily a bad experience, especially if there is a payoff coming. But if there is a payoff coming, it's not really boredom. Or let's say then boredom is a tool or a mean towards excitement. So it's okay for a piece to be boring, but by being boring it becomes even more exciting afterwards. If a piece is boring and it stays boring, it's not really okay. But even if we assume that, I don't know if Jonathan would agree with that, but even if he agreed that a piece could be extremely boring and still be a great piece, I think that there is such an emphasis on this idea of holding the attention of the audience, and this idea of not being boring, that this could be the kind of main principle or the main criteria at work in Jonathan's conception of composition and choreography. So here I had to do something to question again, and that's what I'm going to do. So if you think of the idea of holding the attention of the audience, it's something that is very important in many fields, and it's especially important in the entertainment industry, in mass media, in political communication, in the growing field of communication in general. And if you look at the examples that Jonathan takes or uses in his book, they are coming a lot from those fields. He talks about an Elvis Presley song. He talks about how horror films are made. He talks about firework displays and about the tricks of editing which television uses to keep us from changing channels. And I find that so Jonathan is importing composition strategies coming from the field of entertainment and popular culture. And not only is he importing the way of structuring pieces, but also a certain way of thinking about composition. And I find that this recalls a bit what pop art did, or what pop artists like Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein did, except they imported the images. Here I have a painting by Roy Lichtenstein. So here he clearly imports an image from a comic, and so pop art imported the iconography and images from popular culture and entertainment, but Jonathan doesn't import actual material. He doesn't import movement or sound or images or costumes. He imports the way of thinking. For example, if we thought about a Michael Jackson clip, Jonathan won't take like specific movement or sound or ways or like explicit references to Michael Jackson, but he might like try to study how the clip is made in order to hold our attention and to be most exciting. And maybe he's going to use those ideas in order to make a piece. And in both cases are very different, but in both cases, this kind of importation tends to challenge our conception of what is entertainment and what is art, and the boundary in between, and the relationship between both. So, but it tends to blur the distinction, but the blurring is different in the case of pop art and in the case of Jonathan Burroughs. And I'm going to talk about Jonathan Burroughs, not pop art, but Jonathan Burroughs establishes a common frame of analysis that can apply to all type of communications. This principle I talked about, the idea of holding the attention of the audience and the idea of not being boring, he uses two key principles for that. And if you have ever been in a workshop with Jonathan Burroughs, you must have heard this principle. So he says, the rate of change should change and be both predictable and unpredictable. So I'm just going to repeat that, this is very dense. The rate of change should change and be both predictable and unpredictable. So the rate at which things change should change, not remain the same, and things should never be completely predictable or completely unpredictable. Although we would get bored, because if it's completely predictable, we know what's going to happen next, and if it's completely unpredictable, we know we don't know what's going to happen next. So this is like in a nutshell kind of Johnson's. I'm simplifying a lot, but I have to be kind of fast. But it's kind of his what we could call Johnson's theory of composition. And this principle, they can apply to all kinds of cultural products and all kinds of about everything that is composed. So you can analyze a Haydn concerto with it, or a reggae tune, as what Jonathan does, and you can analyze about anything. So it creates a common frame of analysis, and it allows us to make unexpected links, or to see perspectives that were not so obvious between domains we are not used to associate. But now, I would like to see what might be the problematic aspect of this way of looking at choreography and composition. And when I say problematic, I don't mean it as a bad thing, but actually as a strong thing, because most interesting ideas are problematic one way or another. So this is quote by Oscar Wilde, where he says, an idea that's not dangerous doesn't deserve to be called an idea. So I was curious in which way Jonathan's idea could be dangerous. I think one of the first, I mean, maybe not dangerous, but one of the first problems that we could see with this conception of choreography is that it relies on the conception of the audience as a homogeneous entity. Jonathan often talks about the audience. He says, it's about what the audience sees. The audience likes to have a job to do. Your audience will become exhausted. The audience wants to care what happens next. Audiences like changes. Audiences like differences. And there are many more of this kind of statement about the audience. And of course, the audience is very diverse, like all of you tonight. Like, you have your different persons, and you have different tastes and feelings, and maybe you have different understanding of what I'm saying. But, and of course, Jonathan is aware of that, but this way of looking at composition tend to emphasize more what's common about all of you than what's different. It tends to emphasize the what's common about all your way of appreciating the composition of this talk. But and I think that can have problematic aspects, that it emphasizes the sameness and not the diversity. Another thing is that the emphasis on holding the attention of the spectator can lead to a paternalist conception of the spectator. Because if the composition is especially crafted in order to hold your attention, you don't have to hold your attention yourself. You don't have to make the effort, you don't have to concentrate in the same way. And for example, Jonathan says, help the viewer follow what's happening and not get bored. This could be a motto for commercials, but also for political discourses. This is used a lot. And there is the danger that the spectator becomes a child that should never get bored, and that get bored if things are not unfolding at a certain pace. If you think of
political discourse is like, if you listen to a discourse by Obama or Sarkozy or whoever, it's not only the content that is partisanized, it's also the way it's composed. Because it doesn't give you the chance to get bored, but it takes you in this kind of entertainment somehow. I think that being aware of this political implication is interesting, because when we think about composition strategies, we can think about it as purely formal choices, as choices that don't have so much impact. But those choices are never neutral. Like, the way you compose is also framed by the way you conceive the person you're addressing to, and in that way it always has a certain political dimension. But now, having drawn out this possible implication, and also this potential of creating a new perspective between different domains, I would like to see how does Johnson's work, whether it's through his workshops or through his pieces or through his book, relate to this implication. So there is something very interesting about the relationship I find in a choreographer's handbook between the text and Johnson's idea about composition. Because the relationship goes both ways. The text formulates and articulates those ideas, so it makes them understandable. And so we can understand these ideas intellectually and eventually think about them and apply them and so on. But the relationship also goes the other way around. The ideas about composition, the principles of composition, shape the text. The text is itself composed according to the ideas. If you look inside, it doesn't look like any kind of book. I mean, I don't know if you can see from here, but there are a lot of blanks, of blank places, and the book plays with predictability and unpredictability and building expectation and fulfilling or not this expectation. And there are repetitions, and there is a certain reason. And the relationship is even more complex, because somehow the way the book is composed has an impact on the ideas, on the meaning of the book itself, on the content of the book. And the content of the book, namely those ideas about composition, has a very strong impact on the way the book is written. So the how and the what are kind of melted together. It's very hard to make a clear distinction between the how and the what. And I think it also appears that if you read Johnson's book, you won't learn how to choreograph. It will rather lead you to question the way you go about choreographing and composing. But so, as opposed to a normal handbook, you don't reach a specific goal. But we might wonder if the fact that we don't reach this goal, and the fact that we end up more questioning composition than learning how to do composition, is not the process of composition itself, is not composition as such. If it's not questioning how you put things together, is not actually what choreography is. This will become more clear, because I want to make a parallel between this and what happens in some of, or my interpretation of what happens in some of Johnson's pieces in a piece by Bruce Nauman I'm going to show you afterwards. So, if you see a piece by Johnson, I mean, when I see a piece by Johnson, I usually laugh, and people around me are laughing, and usually people are very entertained. But if you ask yourself, what is the piece about, it's not easy to answer. Because it seems that the composition is not there to convey the material, but it's rather that the material is there to make the composition possible. And so composition, which is usually the how, becomes in some ways the what. The piece is not conveying anything special except the process of conveying itself. And I think the book works a bit in the same way. It doesn't teach you how to choreograph. It takes you through a process of questioning choreography, but this process of questioning choreography could actually be what choreography is. And I want to show you this piece by Bruce Nauman now. So it's a sailing piece, you can read. And I want to give you a little bit of time to look at it and think about it. And I'm going to read you a quote by Osterman himself, and it's taken from an interview he gave to PBS. So he says, "You can make something that appears to be functional, but when you try and use it, you can't quite figure out what its function might be. And that's, at the end, what its function is, to try to figure out what to do with it." I'm going to read this again. "You can make something that appears to be functional, but when you try and use it, you can't quite figure out what its function might be. And that's at the end what its function is, to try to figure out what to do with it." So if you try to use these stairs, you realize pretty soon that they are kind of useless, because you go up and down and up and down and you're in the same place. And but you have been doing that for a while, and maybe you have been wondering what are these stairs for and so on. And that ends up being the function of these stairs. And I think there is what I said before about this kind of indifferentiation of the how and the what, and this kind of melting of the purpose and the means, or that it becomes very hard to differentiate what is the goal and what is the process to get at this goal. Because so each time it's a bit the same structure. We have a process which is supposed to lead us somewhere, but as we are going through this process, we realize it's not going to get us there at all. And we realize that actually what we went through the process was the actual goal, that there is nothing else beside that actually matters. And now that this is formulated, I'd like to go back to what I said about the potential political implications of Jonathan's way of thinking about composition, and see how it relates to what I just said about the process and the goal. And if you look at composition strategies used by commercial or by political discourses, I mean, they have a very clear aim. They aim to sell you a product. So it's very entertaining in order that you buy the product, or it's very entertaining in order that you get convinced of a specific political or economical claim. And if you think of entertainment where the goal might not be as clearly explicit, there is still the thing that if you watch an entertaining movie or if you listen to a pop song or something like that, there is a part of entertainment which is that you forget that you're entertained. You get into the movie, and you should not be thinking, "Oh, I'm getting entertained now," because then you're not really entertained. And there is something weird about Jonathan's pieces, that they are both entertaining, and they are also about entertainment. So you're entertained, but you're constantly reminded that you are watching something that is about entertainment. So there is a kind of friction like that. And I find that this way of dealing with entertainment subverts the function of entertainment, because the function of entertainment is in some way to forget yourself. And here you're reminded about this process of forgetting yourself. So Jonathan's pieces draw our awareness towards the functioning of entertainment itself. And this functioning of entertainment is what we are constantly subjected in the kind of society we live in, where most messages are composed in a very, I mean, supposedly very entertaining way. And I find it interesting as a way to draw attention to that. Thank you.
Ja, Yeah, I would like to invite Jonathan and Scott so that we combine the discussion and audience questions so that we take Noé's talk to launch into a... Any questions for or remarks on Noé's talk?
I have one. No, I just wanted to. I was thinking about the thing of it shouldn't be boring, and it's something that whenever I teach a workshop, there's always somebody who says, but why shouldn't it be boring? I mean, why can't it be boring? And then I always feel it's a too easy rhetorical stance. And so I think my intention behind that idea that it shouldn't be boring was something more like, of course it's okay for a piece to be boring. I've made them and I've seen them. I've seen wonderful work that had that quality. My provocation, I think I'm intending, is that it should then at least become a choice. That it's not something that you think afterwards, this is okay. Well, which it may be, but that somehow it was intended as a provocation towards choice.
I just wanted to say that I was not advocating for boredom. I mean, or trying to say we should make boring pieces, but what's interesting? I mean, if I find like if you compare this handbook with other handbook in art from before, is that sometimes there are clear principles like of, you know, a piece should be symmetrical or it should not be symmetrical, or there are principles for like a piece should be beautiful or it should be whatever. And it's not easy in that book to see what those principles may be, and that's why I went to this whole idea of questioning and so on. And I think that in general, it's something that's not easy in a way to, I mean, because when you told me about this, he was saying that he would be interested in someone younger saying something about how he could relate to that. And in some way, the fact that it's so open and that it questions itself so much makes it hard, I find, to relate to. Because if you have something very clear and very straightforward, it's very easy to either contradict or to go with it. But here, it's so plastic that it's very hard to position yourself toward it.
Yeah, I mean, when you said, is it possible to write a choreographer's handbook, I immediately wrote my notebook, no. and I think it isn't, and of course I question all the questions, I have to say that. This thing about boring, it was something like that. I've sensed from workshops when we've been, when it's come up and we always discuss it, that it becomes a benchmark for the idea of a certain autonomy of the artist. I can make something that is okay if it, boring seems to be a bottom line or something what I think is a constructive freedom, of a kind of fantasy of freedom. And I somehow wanted to try and pull at that a little bit, or represent those conversations more than demand that it must entertain, I think.
You said something about choice making a little earlier, which isn't, I don't think you used the word, I don't think you referred to the word choice when you were...
Not so much,
I think, because when I read the book, I found that the conditions out of which work emerges, which is the relationship between yourself and maybe yourself and others, is one in which you're faced with constantly making choices. And how is it that the space is constrained in different ways? And those constraints no longer operate by the handbook kind of rules that you might have gotten with Doris Humphrey. They simply don't operate that way. But there's a sense in the way something seems to be the right choice under certain conditions. And I felt that in reading the book, that a lot of the conditionals were offered to me through the process of questioning, that I recognized in the book, which is one of the reasons I said I gave it to the designers, who are also faced with making choices under certain conditions, and they recognized in the book immediately themselves in a creative process of trying to decide on the basis of an intuition, but an intuition which is informed by the sense that, you know, there is a history to the work, there is a context, that there is, even though I think you're right, interesting this notion of the homogeneous audience or not, but nevertheless, you have a readership, you have a feeling for what that readership is going to respond to. And those were the sorts of dynamics I picked up in the book, a lot around this notion of making choices.
I was thinking in response to when Scott was saying about the desire for artists to disseminate ideas, and I liked what Scott was saying because it seemed very positive. And on the other hand, I had this this picture in my mind of the fact that within the dance world, where we don't make a lot of money from selling our objects, most of us are forced to teach. So that we have a situation where ideas are disseminated actually by most of us faster than we have managed to absorb or investigate them ourselves. So this is a strange world for a younger artist to come into, because they are overwhelmed by what are called tools, which are flying in all directions,
yeah.
And partly from economic need as much as from a desire to disseminate or investigate further by onward passage of the ideas. And I think, although in what I wrote, I do put some things which I found useful, and you could call methodologies, which I have used. I, on the whole, was trying to trying to reflect as much as of that flying material in the air as I could, but without any of those things becoming tools. But somehow that they're, for a moment, we can see them more in relation to each other. But I say not becoming tools, because the tool suggests if you use this, that will happen. And my experience is that that's not the case with any of these ideas. There's no guarantee. It has to be the right idea for the right person in the right context.
Well, this is really kind of a screw, but for me, it was.
I certainly found, since I wrote it, it's been of very little help to me, personally, in trying to decide what I might make or how I might make it. And in a way, I quite like that, because I sense that that's the point, that I have to start still from the beginning. It hasn't developed any knowledge for myself.
Like, for me, it was just saying, look, you can do anything you like. But in a much more complex way, it doesn't say anything.
So long as it's the right thing.
As long as it's the right thing.
Well, it's difficult to sustain a relationship with things that go out, like, for example, the improvisation technologies, CD-ROM, that if you were to assume that that's the way Bill is making work, that would be wrong, because one of the things he said is that once he fixed those ideas in that kind of way, I mean, what he has said, I've heard him say, is that then it allowed him to move on. I don't think that's exactly right either, actually, but something like that happens. So this, and M.A.M. Peter said this, you know, the effort to sort of fix the thing, which was a struggle, and also they confronted, it wasn't the happy relationship with fixing ideas, but it was deemed to be, and I think it was useful. It was useful in the sense that it did engender other relationships around those ideas that wouldn't have been engendered otherwise. Mm. But the fact that they're not actually fixed has to be constantly reasserted, because of our tendency to read into them that's the way something's done. And that, but in fact, we have to constantly keep throwing them up. I think that's one reason the more of these things that are out there, one might say, the better. Because they represent, then it's more of a diverse ecology of ideas. That's one way of thinking about it.
I was struck by Noe talking about the composition of political discourses, because my daughter works for an NGO in Africa, and she was part. I remember her telling me she was part of us. A rally in Trafalgar Square for Make Poverty History, where they'd invited Mandela to speak. And she showed me the front pages of the newspapers the next day and explained how she and her team had set up the situation of where Mandela stood, where the slogan Make Poverty History was in relation to him, and where the photographers and camera crews would stand, so that the photographers and camera crews had no choice but to take a picture of Mandela's face with the slogan behind him. And it altered forever my perception of the coverage of events, because I understood that even for the best reasons, and this was for the best reasons, it was completely constructed. And the photographers are used to and happy with that construction of their work somehow.
Yeah, because maybe I'm coming back a bit, because I think what's funny with if you think about Doris Humphrey's book, I mean, like her, I don't think anyone took her book and applied, I mean, maybe some people did that, but if someone took Humphrey's book and applied it, didn't make very interesting things. Yet people could do something with it in another way. And what I'm really curious about is, with this kind of book, which already integrates some of the questioning, some of the relationship we might have to, how other people might relate to, and that's kind of what I try to inquire. And then I think we are bound to do something, we are bound to somehow corner it a little bit and to be a bit unfaithful to it. Other way we can't really even relate to, I mean, it's the other way it becomes almost impossible to relate to. So you think about boredom, but I think what becomes the way to corner it, I mean, the way it will be usually cornered is that what's almost statistically most there, like what's most present will become what it says at some point. Even if you know that it's more complex and more delicate, usually what happens is that everyone, when they think about Descartes, they say cogito ergo sum and stuff, but of course that's not what he's, I mean, that's part of a much bigger discourse, and it's much more complex, but that's what remains somehow. So I also was wondering about that, and how the fact that you already include our own questioning in your own thinking process, how that might affect our own thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I would only say that I would tend to I would tend to agree with what you're saying and think, but I would go beyond that and think that I suspect that all workshop teaching to do with making performances has the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And all mentoring, I sometimes think I'm not sure any of this does any good, except it keeps us with an income so that we can all go on working. except then I have to step back and remember workshops that I've taken, which probably rank as highly, in terms of experience, as highly as performances that I've seen, and stay with me and come back to me regularly. But in this, I did collect, over 5 years I was running a discussion workshop, and I did collect a massive amount of material from a massive amount of people, only a fraction of which is in there, because it was more a problem of making it make sense, and that it shouldn't just be a list of statements. But my hope was that that grounds it in some commonality. That is beyond my aesthetic prejudices, of which I have many.
Do you think audiences would get something from the book, general audiences?
It's too heavy for me to carry around to performances and try and sell, so I probably won't find out. I was thinking about this thing about the homogeneous audience, and I suddenly realized that it's a fantasy that I inherited from, or an idealism that I inherited from Jerome Balanzavi-Loire, who, one of my interpretations of the revolution that they caused was that I'd grown up in this era where almost one of the defining images of dance that you'd hear over and over again was, well, isn't it great? Every member of the audience can have a different interpretation of what they're seeing. And some of the time that was wonderful if you were watching a Most Cunningham and John Cage performance, and other of the time it seemed more of a failure. When I first saw the work of Jerome Bennett and Balanzavi-Loire, I thought they are inviting, when I'm in the audience, they are inviting me to have the same experience as the people sitting around me. And I could see that as limiting my freedom as a member of the audience to have my own experience, but actually I enjoyed it because it felt like something that a performance could uniquely do, which was to invite me for a moment to subsume myself into a larger pool of energy, something that I have experienced at a football match, for instance, and which is not necessarily self-limiting. In fact, in that moment when you feel less yourself, you also catch a glimpse of yourself. So that's where my idealism of the audience comes from.
Which comes up in the book a lot also, a notion that I find very productive is the idea of contract. So the first gesture sets up a contract with the audience and invites them in. which maybe leads them also into reading what Scott has described of all the invisible aspects. And so I don't know whether it actually unifies, but at least on the threshold of the piece, it might do that.
Well, it comes from this this statement that I quote in the book from the writer Adrian Heathfield that you may know. He has worked a lot with Tim Etchells and Forced Entertainment Theatre Company. And he and I, Adrian and I, were teaching a workshop together, and he made this comment that the condition of contemporary performance is that the convention is that we've broken all the conventions, and that this is an unusual situation to come together and experience something. After he'd said it, he questioned himself, and I've since tried to discuss it with him, and he says, I'm not sure. I can see that it makes sense, and I'm also not sure whether it makes sense. But since he said it, it's something I keep noticing. And therefore, the idea that a performance must make a contract with the audience came from somebody else, Martin Del Amo, a choreographer that was in Berlin and now lives in Sydney. And it seemed to me that what Martin Del Amo was describing was the moment when the performance attempts to define something that would pass for a convention, or at least an opening to a common understanding, or an understanding that would be that each member of the audience would find in common, enough that we can go on and figure out the performance as it continues. And there are many genres which remain having a strong convention. When the conductor walks in at the start of the opera, we applaud, for instance. Actually, that one passes over to performances of Matteo and I, because we have two chairs and two scores. Invariably, the audience applauds when we walk on, whether we want them to or not, because it's understood immediately that it's a musical concert and that is the convention, which is quite a benefit, I think. Then we have to do less of work of establishing a contract.
I guess my question about audiences relates a little bit to when you asked the question about audiences with synchronous objects, because if it's an ambition, I don't know if it was your ambition in writing the book that you would also communicate to audience members who perhaps don't have such an who arrive at dances without really much of an insight into how they're made or the conditions of their making, and I think that. You know, that generally there's been this feeling, and that's something that was expressed by Bill when he made Synchronous Objects, is that audiences have difficulty reading abstract dance works or abstract works. And for most people here, that probably isn't the case necessarily, but it nevertheless persists as an idea that audiences have difficulty reading dance works, which are not narrative or are open-ended, and that they struggle with finding meaning. And so they reach for meaning, for example, in narrative or in relationships, and they try to put it together, and then they spend time in an after-show discussion where they ask the choreographer what their intention is and ask for some interpretive hooks to hang their experience off of. But I think some of the ambition for some of these projects is to try to underpin somebody's experience in the theater as an audience member with more information about the thinking related to the experience of making work. Because when I, for example, some of the things that you read, particularly in relation to how material begins to emerge, how material begins to tell you what it needs from you, I think some of the ways in which you describe that experience, I think that, and I have colleagues who are not artists working in the artist field, philosophers, for example, who read those and find that they find some purchase in their experience of watching in relation to these kinds of ideas. And I don't know, is that something that you, do you think that's true or possible or could be positive or?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I wrote it was for myself to try and get a purchase on the fact that I like quite disparate things. I was in a ballet company for 13 years, that's a very long time. And I still like some ballet. But I like many other things also, and somehow I wanted to try and reflect for myself what those different genres or approaches might have in common that you could call them the art form of dance. So in fact, my ideal reader from the very beginning was myself, aged 17, as a ballet dancer, joining a workshop of Steve Paxton. And that somehow, could I explain to myself then what I know now, or have experienced now, and could I expect and trust myself then, if invited with the right words, to not feel threatened by it? Mm-hmm. I think that was the whole thing. Yeah. But at the same time, it had to interest me now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whether it succeeds in that direction or not, I couldn't say. Mm-hmm. But that was somehow the intention. Yeah. And underpinning it was this thing that I write about in the foreword. Of feeling that I've suffered throughout my career from the various battles that arise within the art form of dance, mainly because we're told all the time that what we do is a minority art form and obscure and difficult. So we tend to fight with each other for what is least any of those negatives. And one after the other, in 30 years, I've seen these fights arise and fall away again and actually become irrelevant, be rendered irrelevant by somebody's work. So the fight between ballet and contemporary dance is over, thanks to William Forsythe, for instance. But through all those fights between genres, I was always aware, well, wait a minute, I like Merce Cunningham and I like Pina Bausch. And yet, I would often be in a situation where there was a fight between somebody that would stand up for a methodology of theatricality and somebody that would stand up for a methodology of physical investment and an abstracted body. And I never had that trouble, and I believe that many people don't have that trouble. So it's also putting these ideas together, but somehow trying to lay those ghosts to rest.
Yeah.
And sometimes I doubt that, because since it's been published, I've been thinking, maybe the fights are good and necessary to keep us on our toes. And maybe it's too simplistic and naive to do away with them. It's partly because I read a lot of poetry, and I've been reading, I read a lot of interviews with poets. And boy, in the literary world, they love those fights. they really dig in, you know? We're so polite, share our ideas, whereas they really fight. And then actually, so since then, I thought, well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should slap each other around a bit more and be more, you know, mean it. But
maybe. Although maybe if we produce more of these things, we'll move more in the direction of poets.
Well, maybe the best thing it'll achieve is that, in fact, it'll be the contrary to what I was expecting.
Yeah. It'll establish, yeah.
Yeah, it'll cause fights.
Any candidate for a gladiatorial intervention or question?
Yeah.
That was yours.
No, I've every now and again I've looked at that since it was published and thought, what does that mean? But it was just a rhetorical attack on my boredom with nakedness on stage, I suppose. It just, yeah. And somehow that I've often felt that the impulse to use nudity in performance has been fully investing in the body, and therefore suggesting a body beyond a body, and therefore that came to me the thought that this is about an attempt for an ultimate neutrality, to take away all but the body. But I'm not sure that that's right. But it sounded good. It links to a previous. It was a choreographic device that links to a previous statement that says something like, something is no more neutral than a large hat. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what I actually wrote.
Yeah. I think it's also being naked.
Ah, it is. Nudity is no more neutral than a large hat, or something like that. Yeah. Well, just that it was Wendy Houston, who's a dancer and choreographer from England that you may know from her extraordinary work with Lloyd Newson in the films like Strange Fish. And she'd been somewhere like Impulse Dance, and she said to me, you know, the problem with these workshop festivals is that you could come away thinking there are loads of ideas, and you can browse here and there, and then you would have lots of ideas. And she said, my experience is that there are very few ideas, and when you find a good idea, then you make a piece. And I found that quite liberating. So, and then it made me think, well, yes, what's the economic situation that leads to all these workshops and this idea of a multiplicity of possible ideas? And then I was thinking, well, yes, I teach to make money to allow me to make work, and I'm teaching so fast that I'm sometimes teaching at the edge of what I've investigated, which can be interesting, but not necessarily. I mean, certainly wouldn't hold in the field of in many other fields of teaching. No, desperately clinging to the few that I have, and very quickly thinking of new ones as the old ones get worn out. That's what I mean. That there are not so many ideas. That's quite liberating. That somehow we have to accept our limitations. I heard Ivana Muller give a talk a few weeks ago in Arnhem, and she said, I feel very inspired by how limited the body is. It's something, what I'm saying is something connected to that, rather than the mythology that the body is endless, has endless possibility, and there are endless ideas. Somehow you can be at ease then, and accept what ideas you do have, rather than the toolbox idea, situation which suggests here are all sorts of ideas and I can just pick at random, and I can choose which ones I want, which has been the more normal way of writing about choreographic practice. I think for many people, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking just for myself, but my usual experience of making work is a long wait for something that is not even yet an idea, but maybe points in the direction where an idea might be. And even then, 70% of the time, it's not, and you have to start again. But then that's what keeps you going. I don't mean to sound gloomy. Does that make sense? Hey? Yeah, well.
Well, it makes me, because you were talking about what, Ivana,
Emily, yeah.
She said about the body being limited, because I picked up, Jonathan did a series of conversations back in late 90s. You published that little South Bank book. One was with Michael Clark, and Michael Clark was fascinated by the idea the body was unlimited in that interview. I looked at it just recently.
He was fascinated that it was unlimited.
That he preferred to, in his imagination, he preferred to think of it as unlimited.
Yeah, but his body kind of was unlimited. You know, he's the exception, not the rule.
Right. So there's an interesting, yeah, so the context for his thinking is, of course, his own physicality experience, in part.
Yeah, yeah, perhaps that's it.
But the other, you know, the other thing about ideas is we can talk about them proliferating and there being many or being maybe too many. But sometimes is to give the idea that the idea really doesn't take shape until it has a context. And the context itself, you know, is a kind of, it's a sort of outer layer sort of idea. But it has, that you can only recognize the idea in the kind of context that's emerging. And then the conditions that give rise to that context within which the idea emerges is the sort of thing I take away from the way in which you describe process in your book, so that the idea doesn't just, so the toolness aspect of your book isn't actually something you can just reach in and pick out, but you've got to kind of reach it in and you've got to tug it out a bit, and as you tug the idea out, it pulls a bunch of other stuff out, and that you've got to watch out as it comes out, and you might have to catch that there, is it, so that everything's contingent on everything else, and that's really the place within which you know, that's another way of thinking about the ideas, what kind of purchase they have on other things around them. And that they, I think, now I'm trying to, when you were saying, and you asked the question about what Jonathan was saying about ideas coming really, you know, quickly, working very quickly, kind of the edge, making up new ones, I mean, I think that it has always struck me that in the studio, how quickly one can work. Wayne McGregor works extremely quickly in the studio, almost as if that's his motor, and makes decisions very, very fast. He does a lot of, you have the feeling he's done a lot of background research, and then he trusts himself to make a lot of very, very fast decisions, very, very quick. Produces material very, very quickly, lots of material, and then edits it down. So that would be a very different way of thinking about how what he's doing with ideas in that context.
Well, and the thing in there about accepting what comes easily that Noe was talking about was just that I noticed in dance has developed in certain areas a mythology of long, slow, hard process.
Mm.
Of intensive research, of a mode of working which is cathartic and visceral. And I think that this can be the right way to work, but it's not the only way to work. And I was liberated by Steve Paxton saying 3 hours is the maximum amount of time that you can focus physically. Mm-hmm. So ever since, I tried only to work for 3 hours because I had the blessing. and it works somehow. And before that, I was trying to do whole long days, which is what many people do. They get the money and then they go into the studio for 8 hours a day and they go crazy. So it was a little bit of an attempt, a rhetorical attempt to liberate some other people towards shorter working hours.
I was thinking about what you were saying, because in some way there are many, many ideas, and at the same time there are not so many ideas. I mean, and then I think that there are many ideas, but there are not many ideas that really seem to matter. And also what you said about the thing that in some way you wrote, there was something with the book about having been through times of antagonism with different people having different conception and fighting for different conception. And I think that, or it seems to me that today these antagonisms are less present. It's, you know, the same person are going to like Michael Jackson, Pina Bausch, Merce Cunningham, William Forsythe, and Jerome Bell. It's not really a problem. Like, most people like...
No, that's the problem now.
Yeah, maybe it's a problem. But I think it's linked to this thing that there are so many ideas, but that maybe because there is nothing really to fight for, because there is no there is nothing at stake. I mean, it's never really a problem to impose an idea to about anyone. I mean, I'm exaggerating a lot, but there is something linked to this problem of antagonism, of many ideas, and of few ideas that matter. And even the way you wrote the book, this thing that there are many quotes, and many quotes from students or from people that are, and that you compiled a huge amount of, it made me think a bit about this WikiLeaks thing, that you know, they have like tons of material, and then they do like statistical research, and they come up with the most interesting thing. It's a very different process to write a book than to actually develop. And I think it's also linked to this kind of landscape where the antagonism are not so strong anymore.
It feels like the global economy and globalized cultural economy is bringing about what Marshall McLuhan and then John Cage after him idealized about a multiplicity of events and possibilities, which I think turns out to be more confusing than perhaps they anticipated, because of in such a wide field of choice, I have more difficulty to orientate myself somehow, because I'm always pulled in several directions, and exactly what you said, I can't easily find what's important, most important to me. So I see it as a positive, but also it as probably one of the most important questions at the moment is how we deal with that as individuals. Because being overwhelmed it doesn't bring us freedom somehow.
Yeah, this brings up a lot of questions actually, I find. So I don't know whether we take a pause or go on in an informal way.
Have a drink.
It felt like a nice conclusive speech about how one can deal with the internet becoming also a major medium for artists to start their research on Mises. So yeah, let's have a drink and continue informally. Thank all of you for coming. Thank Jonathan, Scott, and Noe for contributing. If you don't have the book yet, there's still a few copies for sale there. And the next salon will happen on the 10th of March in La Baie Connective. So write down the date. And